within the trails we ride.
You're listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick is a horseman, trainer, international clinician, and author who helps empower horse people from all over the world with the skills, knowledge, and mindsets needed to create trusting partnerships with their horses. Warwick offers a free 7-day trial to his comprehensive online video library that includes hundreds of full-length training videos and several home study courses at videos.warwickschiller.com. Just because you see.
G'day everyone, welcome back to the Journey On podcast. I'm your host Warwick Schiller and my guest this week is Sarah Louise Lilly. If you guys have ever heard anything about a healing modality called tapping, that's what Sarah does. So she is a clinical emotional freedom technique practitioner. She loves helping people overcome fears, blocks and phobias, as well as supporting equestrians who've had traumatic falls and helps them get back in the saddle with ease and confidence. Sarah also mentors the next generation of EFT practitioners at EFT Universe, the world's largest EFT certification program, recently teaching there alongside Dorshan Church at the Omega Institute. She's a former actor with numerous network credits. She's also a mom and an avid equestrian, always counting down the days till she can get back on a horse. Does some amazing work out there in the world, especially not only with, but especially with helping equestrians get back on their horses after a fall. And this was cool. I always had a bit of an interest in this tapping and didn't know much about it and got to learn quite a bit about it talking to Sarah. And I hope you guys enjoy this chat as much as I did. Sarah Louise Lilly, welcome to the Journey On podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
No worries at all. So tell me, you are an EFT practitioner. I think we're talking about that a lot. Can you tell us a little bit about what EFT is?
Yeah. So at its simplest, it's a stress reduction technique. It combines elements of modern Western psychology with the ancient art of acupressure. So it's also called tapping because as you're focusing on something traumatic, upsetting, stressful, you're tapping on these acupressure points on your face and torso, which really counter conditions that upsetting stimulus, right? So you have this mechanical way to literally send calming signals to your brain to tell the body it's safe, it's okay, it can relax. Studies show it literally lowers your cortisol. So now you can choose how you want to show up. You can choose how you react to this stressful event, this trauma, as opposed to coming from a triggered, stressed out, or habitual place. So that's kind of the very basic definition. It can be used for anything from severe phobias. It has incredible results with severe PTSD and veterans. It can be used to kind of unhook habitual patterns that come from limiting beliefs, any sort of trauma. I work with a lot of equestrians who've experienced traumatic falls and, you know, really struggling with anxiety in the saddle. So that's kind of the basis of it. But again, it can be used for kind of everyday stressors, just like something like as a parent, you know, I'll speak from experience, my, you know, son, slams the door in my face and I immediately want to yell and be like, right? And it gives me a tool right away to kind of calm my body, to center myself so I can open the door and choose how I want to talk to him as opposed to coming from that stress place. So it's an everyday tool. It's very practical. And you can also use it for very sort of severe traumas, phobias, phobias of flying, car accidents, more severe sort of big T traumas as well.
Wow. So you use this in a therapeutic setting as far as people come to you and it's almost like a therapy session where it's like talk therapy where you're talking through things and you tap at the same time. Is that what you do?
Yeah. So it's a peer-to-peer model. So more of a coaching session, I would say, than therapeutic setting, but it's definitely like a cognitive aspect. So you're talking and focusing on the stressful thing or the traumatic thing as you're tapping. Now you don't actually have to verbalize it. Sometimes a client might, for any number of reasons, not feel comfortable talking out loud about it, or maybe they prefer to, they don't want me to know what they're working on for some reason. And then of course you can just focus on it, right? You can just really tune in. You can think about it. as opposed to say it out loud. So as long as you're focusing on it, that's the piece that we want to do. So we really want to focus on it so we can counter conditioning it with this calming response.
Is it, I don't know if you know anything about EMDR, but if you do, is it anything like EMDR? Because EMDR like has a tapping component to it as well. Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely overlap with those two techniques. EMDR uses a lot of eye movements. We use those in EFT as well to kind of process memories. You know, those eye movements activate the theta and delta, those subconscious brain waves, which activate in our sleep. So we process that way. I do resource tapping, which is kind of amplifying some of the good feelings, which is an EMDR technique too. So there's definitely overlap in terms of those two as well.
Okay. Definitely. I've done some EMDR and they didn't really do, I know I'm aware of the eye thing, but they didn't really do the eye thing. They sat right in front of me in a chair and tapped on my either hands, like tapped rhythmically on the backs of my hands, that bilateral stimulation. And I think they've also done it tapping on my, just the top of my knees, just, you know, where my knees and thighs kind of join. And that's why I was thinking it might be related there, because most of the EMDR that I've done was not the, you know, moving your eyes back and forth.
Yeah. So that bilateral just stimulates that right and left hemisphere, right? So yeah, there's a lot of bilateral work in EMDR. I don't want to speak to it too much because I personally have not experienced it. I know a lot of EMDR practitioners, and we've talked a lot about kind of the overlap. But yeah, as I understand it, yeah, there's a lot of that bilateral, and you may or may not, as you said, do those eye movements.
Right. So how did you get into the tapping, into the emotional friend technique? What was your start?
Yeah, so I first heard about it through Gabby Bernstein, who's a self-development writer. And, vaguely aware of her, you know, vaguely aware of tapping through her. I'd done a couple of her videos probably a decade plus ago. And then almost 5 years ago now, I went through a big traumatic event in my own life. And my husband, I'm happy to talk about it. He's happy if I talk about it, had a big stroke and almost, you know, very traumatic for our whole family. And post that event, as we all kind of tried to figure out the new normal post that, tapping was just instrumental in my kind of healing and processing of that trauma. And that trauma showed up in very obvious ways in terms of being hypervigilant, of, you know, remembering that day so vividly, and also in ways that at first I didn't put together. Like it showed up in my horse riding in ways I hadn't realized. And EFT just really just allowed me to process that whole period in a way that was just really profound. And as I was kind of shifting and transitioning in that year after my husband's stroke, I just really felt called. I was an actor before that, and I just switched gears entirely to becoming certified and becoming a practitioner. So I really took a, from the outside, may have felt like a, you know, a sharp turn. But ironically, I think my skill set as an actor and my skill set as a practitioner are actually very much, very similar. And it's really kind of a way for me to activate my purpose, my calling, whatever you want to call it, in a much more tangible way as a practitioner than I ever felt as an actor. So it actually feels very much in line with my kind of bigger vision.
Right. So tell us all about the acting thing, because it's interesting. I think, you know, a little bit I know about, excuse me, about acting, it's quite a somatic thing anyway. You have to be able to be in your body to portray different emotions and things. Tell us about your acting career. How did you get into acting, and what sort of acting did you do?
So did you have Blue Peter as a kid? It was in Australia. Was Blue Peter that children's show in Australia? Did you have that as a kid?
Blue Peter.
Blue Peter.
That's a sailing term, isn't it?
It is, but it was like an educational TV show. It was like for kids. And I wanted to become a Blue Peter presenter. It was a British TV show. I grew up in England. And I thought maybe they had it in Australia too. That's why I mentioned it. And I first wanted to be an actor because they hired actors to be presenters for that show. So that was like my entry point. And it was something I wanted ever since I was a kid. Like I just really resonated with it. And I think actors all have their different processes, right? In terms of how they get into character, what works for them. And I always came through my body, right? Always came through that somatic approach. My biggest challenge as an actor was I would get stuck in my head. And that was never where I wanted to be, never felt good. And so all the practices that helped me as an actor, Alexander technique, Feldenkrais, were all about Michael Chekhov, all these techniques that were about getting out of your head and into your body. And yeah, that was always just what was most effective for me. When I first moved to New York, I did a lot of really wacky avant-garde theater. I worked with Richard Foreman, who's a kind of avant-garde, seminal avant-garde director. And we did all sorts of kind of wild performance work with him. We took that show to Tokyo and all over Europe, which was super fun. I did a lot of kind of movement theater and contact improv in that period, just lots of big movement, which is all kind of somatic based. And then as I got older, I focused more on TV and did a lot of kind of the New York TV shows, the bread and butter of the New York actor, Law and Order and Mysteries of Laura and Emergence, various TV shows here in New York. So that was kind of my trajectory as an actor.
So it all started out from this Blue Peter thing. How old were you at the time when you decided I want to be a presenter on Blue Peter?
Probably I had to be like 7 or 8, I think. Pretty young. But what's interesting then, right, is that now as I look back on that, what I wanted was that life. You know what I mean? Like in this TV show, it was like, it was such a cute TV show. I think it's the longest running children's TV show in England, maybe in the world even. And I was not allowed to watch television as a kid. I was only allowed to watch half an hour of television a day. So my choices were pretty much Blue Peter or John Craven's News Round, which was a news show for kids. So I had very limited choices for TV. So in this half hour TV show, they would have these three segments where they'd have the presenters just kind of talk to someone really cool, like a famous chef or an author, and it'd be a little segment about that. Then there'd be some craft or cooking segment where they'd make, like really cool pencil holders out of like loo rolls or some sort of crafty thing that I loved, right? Or be cooking, or they'd cook something. And then they'd have like an outdoor segment where either they just kind of garden and do some gardening in the little garden they have, or they'd go like into the country and like meet someone in the country or something. It would be an outside segment. So, I wanted to be an actor because they hired actors to do that job. And then I became an actor and loved that. But when I think back, it was like, oh, I just wanted the lifestyle. I wanted to like make cool things out of loo rolls and be creative. I wanted to meet cool people and have great conversations. And I wanted to like spend time outside, which is kind of what I want now. So it got kind of diluted into being an actor. But really, later I realized, oh, the genesis was not actually acting at all. The genesis was like, I wanted that lifestyle that I perceived as a 6 or 7 year old that they had.
Right. So it wasn't like you wanted to be Meryl Streep or something.
No. I never had the, no. And I think I wanted to do something fun. My dad was, worked really hard and growing up and just, traveled a lot, was not around a lot, really just like worked so hard to provide for his family. And I have so much compassion for that. And it also made me, the story I told myself was, yeah, like that doesn't look fun. I want to do something like super fun.
What did your dad do?
He was a chemical engineer.
Okay.
So he kind of ran kind of chemical aerospace kind of companies.
Did he travel around the world doing that or just around the UK?
He traveled. He traveled all over. He was told when he first joined the company out of university that, at some point he might move to America. And then after, a couple of decades, he kind of forgot about it. And then one day they were like, okay, in 2 months, you're moving to the US. So we all picked up and moved when I was 16.
Mm, and that's how you ended up in New York.
Yeah. So we moved to New Jersey, to be fair. So not too far from here, about an hour away.
And where in the UK are you from?
Chichester. Although I moved, I say Chichester because that's where I lived before we moved. It's on the South Coast, by the Sussex Downs, where I rode horses. It's so beautiful. But I was actually born up in the north of England in Knutsford, which is much further north. So we kind of moved all over.
Okay. Let me get back to your, the beginnings of your EFT stuff, because that's the thing I really want to talk about is, so how old was your husband when he had his stroke?
He was 51.
Okay.
So very young. So you're
quite young for that.
Yeah. He had a hole in his heart that no one knew was there. And that was what caused his stroke. He's since had a heart procedure to kind of close that hole. Although he was also in a very stressful job. And my personal theory is that it wouldn't have happened if he hadn't been as stressed as he was. But the way it happened was so absurd that if I had seen it in a movie, I would have said, that's just ridiculous. So it was actually Christmas morning when it happened. We were at my parents' house. It was 6 a.m. My son had just finished opening his Santa presents, and my husband was opening his present, and he had a stroke right in that moment. So a really wild, it was a wild moment, a wild day.
And how long ago was that?
4.5 years ago. So it'll be five years on Christmas.
And you talked about, so out of how soon after the stroke did you come across EFT?
So I started tapping with a practitioner 6 months, after. As I said, I'd known about it, but yeah, I started working with someone at 6 months.
Right. And what difficulties were you having that you were hoping that the EFT was going to help you with?
So I had such they weren't as strong as flashbacks, but the moment that the sound my husband made when he started to have the stroke, the visual of like what his arm was doing was like seared into my brain, right? In very much kind of a traditional kind of PTSD way. And like those images were seared there in a way that I could flash to in my day-to-day life that felt not helpful. I also, like sleeping next to him in bed once he came from the hospital 3 weeks later, like I was constantly in this state of like, you know, I'm going to wake up and is he going to be alive kind of thing? Like that sense of just at any moment, you know, one of the characteristics of trauma is that sort of violating expectations, right? And the way it happened was so traumatic, right? We're literally opening Christmas presents, literally wonderful moment. And then suddenly that happens, right? It came out of nowhere. There was no warning. And so my nervous system was stuck in this, like, everything seems fine, but any moment something could switch.
Right.
So that was something that I was aware of that EFT really helped me work with. And as I said, it came up in ways I didn't expect too. About a year after my husband's stroke, one of the things I really recommitted to, as you do in those moments when you have those kind of life-changing moments, was my horse riding journey, because it was something that I would always say was my favorite thing to do in the world, but wasn't really doing it very regularly. I do it occasionally. I do it on vacation. But after my husband's stroke, I was like, this has to happen like multiple times a week moving forward. Like why? Who knows? Tomorrow's not guaranteed, right? And so I was riding and I broke my finger riding, which I had a tumor there. Long story. But anyway, it was a minor thing, not a big deal. I was back on the horse in, you know, a few weeks. And I had this like low level anxiety that I couldn't shake and was just ruining my experience riding. Like it just wasn't fun. I could just feel myself in my body, this anxiety. And I couldn't understand. It didn't make any sense. Like my finger was fine. Nothing even bad happened. I literally just went over the jump and, you know, didn't close my fingers and like my finger snapped. It wasn't even a scary moment. And so it didn't make any sense to me. And then when I tapped on that with my practitioner, it was, again, my brain had connected. You can be going over the jump. Everything's fine. You break your finger. You can be, you know, opening presents Christmas morning. Your husband could have a stroke. And so my brain, again, had connected that pattern to my husband's stroke at that point, which was a year and a half after. And I thought I'd kind of really moved through most of that trauma. But again, my brain's a pattern-making machine. So it had connected to that my husband's stroke in that moment. And as soon as I made that connection in the session, it was like my anxiety totally went away riding. It was like night and day. So that was a way in which the trauma kind of showed up in a way that I didn't even know was related to my husband's stroke.
Well, wouldn't you say that, you know, a lot of trauma shows up in ways that you don't think are related, you know, like you have an interaction with someone and, you know, they trigger you for some reason, you know, that makes you mad, whatever. And you don't realize that it's related to, you know, someone, you know, one of your parents said to you as a child or whatever.
Yes.
Just, you know, and I really think that, at least for me, working through my stuff, you know, with different modalities and things like that, it makes you aware of kind of where your stuff comes from. And the thing it's done for me is make me aware that when other people are supposedly being a dick, they're actually not. You know what I mean? It's almost not a choice to, you know, like you didn't choose to go, oh, I'm going to have anxiety about riding my horse now.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It really, I think for me, it really changes your perspective of other people's actions, and you kind of, you know, it kind of makes you curious about wondering where it comes from rather than blaming them for acting in a certain way.
Yes. What I hear and what you're saying is just increases your compassion for others, right?
Yeah.
Because you see someone who's having road rage and it's like, wow, they've got some stuff, right? I really get that. And it's that phrase, right? If it's, what is it? If it's hysterical, it's historical.
I've not heard that, but that's a good one. Yeah.
I don't know who said that. Someone said that, not me. But yeah, that's always, I think that's so true. If you're having this sort of out of sync or disproportionate reaction, it's not about the thing, right? It's about something deeper. And, you know, it's so funny because when I work with clients, I always have them do an intake form, right? And one of the questions on the intake form is, you know, are there earlier events in your life that you think this might be related to? And they list a few things typically. But then when we work it back in the session and we're tracing some of these things back to kind of when is the first time you felt that? What does that remind you of? And we follow the body to those events and the body to those trauma. And they could be little T traumas. It's never what they wrote down cognitively. Right. It's always something like, oh my God, I haven't even thought about that in decades, or oh my God, I forgot all about this memory and it's coming up now. It's never the things that cognitively they think it comes from. It's always something that comes up that we find through the body, through somatics, and that surprises them or they haven't thought about in forever.
Yeah, I wouldn't say the big T's are easy, but the big T's are easy to identify, the big T traumas. And the little T traumas are the ones you didn't even know. You don't even recall them happening because it was so, you know, didn't really amount to anything at the time. You don't even think it's related.
Yeah. And it could be something that you didn't even necessarily experience, right? Like I have clients who inherited phobias around certain animals because their mother and their grandmother had the phobia and they just kind of got it through osmosis, through them hearing about it. They've never actually experienced anything scary with a mouse or a rat, but they've inherited it just because they've heard it from their parents or their mother about having this fear and how scary they are, right? So you can kind of inherit trauma too without even necessarily experiencing it, right? So that secondary trauma can really be, you know, is real too.
Well, that's like inheriting racism or...
Well, yeah,
what,
sure.
You know what I mean? No one's born racist.
That's true.
Inheriting that or inheriting, you know, even like family stories, you know, there's the anecdote about the lady that when she makes her Thanksgiving ham, she cuts the end off it before she bakes it. And her kids say, well, why do you cut the end off it? She goes, well, because mum always cut the end off it. So she goes and asks mum, why'd you cut the end off that Thanksgiving ham? And she says, well, my mum always cut the end off the Thanksgiving ham. So they go to the aged care facility where grandma is and go, hey, grandma, we're really interested. You know, why did you used to cut the end off the Thanksgiving ham? And she said, well, I never had a pan big enough to fit the whole ham in. You know what I mean? So it's not really relative to anything, but it's stuff that's how you do it. And so you continue to do it. There's a really interesting, I don't know if this is actually an experiment, the way I was told the story or wherever I read it, it supposedly was an experiment, but they put these monkeys in this cage. And in the cage was an A-frame ladder in the middle of the cage. And you know, it was a big enough cage they could move around and everything. And they let him get hungry, and then they lowered some bananas to the top of the ladder. And one of the monkeys looked up the ladder and went, oh, bananas, and started to climb up the ladder. And when he did, they sprayed the other two monkeys, who were still on the ground, with freezing cold water until the monkey that was up the ladder, until his feet touched the ground again. Then the water immediately went off. And they repeated this exercise over and over and over to where any monkey that went to climb the ladder, the other two wouldn't let them climb the ladder because they'd know that they were going to get sprayed with cold water. Okay? Until, no matter how hungry they are, no monkey will climb the ladder, because if they do, the other two monkeys will grab them and beat the crap out of them. Okay? Then what they did was they replaced one of the first generation monkeys with a second generation monkey. So they put a different monkey in there who knows nothing about anything. And he goes to climb the ladder when he's hungry to get the bananas, and the other two monkeys grab him and beat the heck out of him. After a while, he won't climb the ladder. Okay? So then what they do is they replace another one of the first-generation monkeys with a second-generation monkey. So now there's a first-generation monkey and two second-generation monkeys. Now the newest monkey, he goes to climb the ladder. The other two monkeys grab him and beat the crap out of him. One of them is doing it because he'll get sprayed with cold water if that other monkey goes up the ladder, but the other one doesn't even know why he's doing it. They eventually replace all three monkeys with new monkeys, and any monkey that tries to climb the ladder, the other two will grab him and beat the crap out of him. Okay, so then what they do is they start replacing monkeys one after another, and it took seven generations of monkeys, which is 21 new monkeys, before they would climb, before it went away enough to where a monkey would climb the ladder and the other two wouldn't do anything about it. But after the first three monkeys, no one knew why they were doing this thing. You know, I've read.
Yeah, it's wild.
And it's interesting about that number seven. You think about the number seven in our culture, like 7 years bad luck if you do this. You know, 7 year itch. You know, that's that number seven. I don't know what the context of that is, but it has something to do with some, you know, it has something to do with things like
it's wild
like that. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I think, I mean, even when like something comes up, even just like a simple practice to kind of get into the body, is just like, if you're feeling triggered, it's like just asking yourself, just like putting your hand on your heart, feeling that somatic sensation in your body of that emotion, and just asking yourself, like, how old is this feeling, right? Is this familiar? And just kind of literally just asking yourself, like, what does this remind me of? And sometimes some memory will randomly pop up, and you can just kind of like connect to that part of yourself and just kind of, you know, hear it a little bit. I don't think we have any, you don't need to fix those parts of us, but we can kind of just hear the fear, hear the nervousness, right? Just validate it. And then it kind of quietens down. So I think those,
I'm currently doing some what they call parts work therapy. You know, it's based internal family system stuff.
Yes,
and it's interesting in that they will have, you know, the therapist will ask a part, how old do you think I am?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I do a lot of that sort of IFS informed EFT. I think, parts works is so powerful.
Right. So in your bio, it says that you are mentoring the next generation of EFT practitioners at EFT Universe. What is EFT Universe?
So EFT Universe, I think, is the largest certification program for EFT. So it's where we have an amazingly robust platform and training certification program to educate, to certify EFT practitioners in specifically clinical EFT. And clinical EFT is the form of EFT I use, which is just means that it's the form of EFT that is used in the clinical trials, used in the studies, and really studied right now. And that's the form of EFT that all the sort of empirical data we have about the efficacy of EFT comes from, that form of EFT. It's run by Dawson Church, he and Peter Stapleton are kind of the two lead researchers on the power of EFT and its effectiveness. And he runs EFT Universe. And it's just, if anyone's interested in getting certified, it's just, I think, a fantastic just really robust program. And I mentor in the practice sessions. I teach there, but also when mentees are doing practice sessions, I give them feedback on those sessions as they're going through the training.
Okay. I did a podcast episode a couple of years ago now that was called Books That Have Influenced Me. One of those books was Mind to Matter by Dawson Church.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he's amazing. I just was at Omega Institute, which is a big retreat center in Rhinebeck, New York, for a week, assisting him for a whole week. He did a course on spiritual intelligence, and then we taught an EFT certification four-day workshop. He's amazing. I mean, he's the research he has done on meditation and EFT is just, yeah, it's amazing. And he has a new book coming out, Spiritual Intelligence, which is all about the four circuits of the brain you have to kind of activate to really get into that bliss brain meditation. So he's...
You know, I've read that book, but I don't know that much about him. What can you tell me about Dawson Church?
He has the best laugh ever. He's one of those people that has one of those laughs that just booms and you just can't hear it without laughing. And he's great, really great hugs. Those two are very front center of my mind because I've known him now, you know, I don't know, over 3 years, but we'd never actually met in person with COVID. So spending a week together in this last week at Omega, I just met him in person, so it was just great to get those physicalities from him that you can't quite get via Zoom. But he is obsessed and beautifully passionate about getting EFT to the masses, to getting it in clinical settings, to getting it in hospitals, doctor's office, for it to be a household name, you know, as soon as possible. And he has really dedicated his life to proving what practitioners have always known, but really giving practitioners and the general public the science and the data and the empirical evidence that proves the efficacy of EFT so that it can be accepted in clinical second settings. So it can be accepted, you know, in more mainstream sort of culture. And I think he's done a really great job with that. It's in Kaiser Permanente in that big hospital chain. He's done over, I think, 100 studies, 300 studies, I believe, on the effects of EFT. There's 100 plus papers in non-English languages that he's supported, made happen. So he's just really, passionate about, spreading EFT and meditation, to be fair, too. He's very passionate about meditation and the power of that and how both modalities, EFT and meditation, really affect your brain, really change your brain. One of the things he said this weekend that really resonated with me was that someone said to me, you know, since you've been doing EFT, I feel like you're more confident. And I was like, huh. And that word didn't particularly resonate with me, although maybe that's true. But I have certainly felt more calm since I've really been doing this work a lot. And what he said this weekend or this last week really resonated to me with that was that EFT changes your brain. You have a new brain. And I thought, that's what it is. I have a new brain since I've been doing this work, since I've been really diving into EFT meditation. I have a new brain. That's really what it feels like. I'm less reactive. I can process things more quickly. And so he's to sum it up, I will say he just brings empirical evidence and data to support the efficacy of EFT.
Right. And he's has a scientific background initially, doesn't he?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's Dr. Dawson Church. Yeah.
Dr. Dawson Church. Okay. That's very cool. Yeah. I didn't know that much about him, but I do remember reading that book. And it was one of those, you know, it was like Bruce Lipton, The Biology of Belief, one of those sorts of books that talks about how thoughts create reality and, you know, how it's all interconnected.
Yeah. Yeah. And he really talks about, meditation from even a scientific background too, right? He kind of created an eco meditation, which he calls a neuroscience based meditation, where it's really designed to activate the circuits in the brain, the emotional regulation circuit, the compassion circuit, the selfing circuit, and the fourth one, I forget. Really designed to activate those circuits in the brain so you can get to that kind of bliss brain state. So you can meditate effectively. And I love that. Yeah, I love that about EFT and meditation, that that we have the science to back it up, that we can really say, this is why this works. I can literally, when we were there, we hooked a lot of people up, myself included, to EEGs. And so as you're doing EFT, you can see the brainwaves change. Right. You can literally see, like, you know, my alpha bridge growing, and my activating my theta, my deltas, I access the childhood memory, and you can really see it happening. Which I've read about that science before, but to see it live with kind of, you know, the brain waves on large screens was pretty cool.
That's got to be really cool to be involved in something like that.
Yeah, it was really cool. So Donna and Gary Bach are these amazing, amazing sort of science data. They brought their EEGs, their mind matter machine, and you literally just hook it up and you can just see. Yeah, I was nerding out about it. It was pretty amazing.
Nerding out about it. So tell me about, you do quite a bit of EFT for equestrians. How did you get into doing that?
So I mean, it really started with that first experience that I had you know, I just realized no amount of kind of positive thinking or traditional mindset tools or traditional sports psychology was going to move that anxiety out of my body, that it really needed that somatic approach. And I think there's a disconnect there sometimes, right? Our sport can have a lot of trauma in it, right? And not all of them. There's some amazing sports psychologists out there, but I also think there are others who miss or are not trauma informed and really focus just on the mindset piece. And if trauma is involved, no amount of positive thinking is going to move that out of your body, right? If you just think about it, right? That's literally in your prefrontal cortex. They're thinking about it. They're thinking positive. And that tag in your brain is in the limbic system that is telling your body it's a threat, that's signaling that amygdala. So no amount of kind of thinking about it is going to move that out of your body. And so that was really where I just felt like there was a hole I could fill, where I could really come in with a trauma-informed modality and say, you know, it's not in your head, it's in your body.
Right.
Right. That would be my billboard, I think. That we have to get into the body. We have to move it out of your body. We have to let your body know it's safe. We have to let your body know that this event is over. You're okay. We have to remove that tag from your brain, so that part of you is no longer kind of trapped in the past, if you will. So it doesn't get re-triggered. So you can show up kind of calm and relaxed again. So that was really, that was my passion to really support those riders. And I know from experience how frustrating it was. It was so frustrating of just being like, why am I anxious? I don't get it. This is so annoying. What is happening? This makes no sense. And it felt like my body was out of control. And clients say that to me all the time. It just feels like my body's out of control. And what I say to that is, your body is not out of control. Your body is a badass at keeping you safe. Your body is like, do not do this thing. I'm going to send out all the alarms. Do not do it. Right? It is like working its ass off for you. We just need to like redirect that. We just need to go back and let your body know it's okay. It doesn't have to raise the alarm, right? So it doesn't keep hijacking you. My two things. One, I experienced it myself. And two, I deeply empathize with that frustration and that heartbreak of like wanting to do something that you just love, that is your passion, that you just, everything in your being wants to do, but you feel like you can't, or something's getting in the way of enjoying that.
And so how did you get your, I mean, you were your first equestrian client.
That's true.
How did you get your second equestrian client?
How did I get my second one?
Was it someone you knew from the stables or whatever?
Yeah. So I said to my trainer, I really want to start working. Yeah. I said, I really want to start working with more, you know, like horse riders who kind of experienced trauma. I feel like there's a hole here. And I was like, do you know anyone that I could, you know, that might want to have a conversation with me and see if I could help? And they were like, oh yes, I can think of 10 people. So it wasn't quite that many, but, and sent me a couple of people right away. I remember going to a little horse expo and meeting people there, and everyone knew someone who struggled with anxiety. Right. Like everyone knew someone. I think it's incredibly common. And, it was just word of mouth after that.
And do you do these sessions live, like in person, or are they Zoom type sessions?
Yeah. So I do mostly on Zoom. I do work one day a week in person. I have an office at Body Positive Works in New Jersey. So I work one day a week with people in person, but majority of my clients are on Zoom. And it's just as effective on Zoom, right? It's it's mirroring. It's, you know, kind of Simon Says, I'm tapping on my body as they're tapping on their body. It's just as effective via Zoom. So I'm grateful for that, right? I was on Zoom pre-pandemic, but it really allows me to work with people all over the world. So that's really a gift.
My question would be, are the places you tap similar for everybody? Is there like a pattern that unlocks the body, or do you tailor the tapping depending on what's going on with the person?
Yeah, great question. So it's the same basic recipe, the sort of 9 points on the face and torso that we use, that if you're, you know, familiar with Chinese medicine, kind of covers all the main meridians in your body. So you're tapping on these end of meridian points, which are used in acupressure, have been used in acupuncture for centuries. If I'm in more of a medical setting, or I'm doing group work for doctors or nurses, which I've done, I'll say that we're tapping into the primovascular system, which is a scientific name for meridians, to kind of use their language so it appears less woo-woo. So you're tapping on the primovascular system. Collagen is the little kind of transmitter that's sending that signal to your brain. But yeah, and then naturally points that when we're stressed, we naturally kind of tap on anyway. Like if you're stressed, you like rub your temples maybe, or you put your fingers, you know, you put your face in your hands, or you put your hands on your head, or you kind of naturally, when you're stressed, use these points. Mm. We just kind of systematize them.
You know, what's really interesting is when you're talking to scientific people, you have to not offend them by not using any Eastern medicine type jargon. You have to kind of westernize it for them. Otherwise, some of them might reject it.
Yeah. Yeah. So Peter Stapleton, who's one of the lead researchers in EFT, and she talks a lot about this, and she's done amazing work for EFT. And she literally hasn't used the word meridian, I don't think, in like a decade plus. She always just talks about the primovascular system because, yeah, she talks about how she goes into, like, she has a lot of work in hospital settings. She's really trying to get it into hospitals and doctor's offices. And she says, if you start using words like meridian or even acupressure, she's like, she just sees doctors' eyes kind of glaze over, right? They just kind of zone out. Whereas if you talk about like it's exposure therapy, but instead of breath, we're using tapping. We're tapping into the primovascular system. It uses collagen as the transmitter. They're like, okay, got it. And if you say things like, instead of saying somatic, you say fourth wave or body-based, they're like, okay, it's a fourth wave. They're using collagen. Okay, that makes sense. Whereas if you say like acupressure and meridians and Chinese medicine, they just kind of glaze over and like are not interested. So I think it's important to know your audience and just use their language. You know, she talks about it in a really empowered way because she just says, yeah, just use their language. That's what they're comfortable with. Just use their language, and it's going to be more effective communication, which I think is true.
Yeah, I think you do have to sometimes tailor things to audiences. You know, I have people will ask me about some of my YouTube videos, and you know, a lot of times I'll ride in either like a side pull or maybe even a rope halter or I use a Bozal a lot, and I'll have people say, so do you feel like that's, you know, Bozal is better than a bit or nicer or whatever? And I go, no, actually I'm trying to usually the video is nothing about what's on their head, on the horse's head. It's about, I'm trying to get people to think about some other things differently. Mm. And there's a certain percentage of the population that will not hear the message. If the horse had a bit on, they'd be highly offended by that. And it's a Rumi quote that says, he was pointing at the stars and they were staring at the end of his finger. And it's a bit like that. And so if you want to get a message across, you kind of have to deliver the message in the way that the most people will get the message that you're trying to deliver. And sometimes you have to, you know, sometimes you have to make allowances for people's biases and their lenses that they view the world through. Yeah. And isn't it interesting how the medical system, they're supposed to be helping us, but they kind of get indoctrinated into Western medicine. You know, you've got to solve it with a pill. You know, it's not about having a more holistic view to where you're looking at what's causing this disturbance, you know, disease, as Dawson Church probably talks about, is dis-ease in the body. Yes. And why wouldn't you want to address the cause of the dis-ease rather than giving the disease a pill or a whatever, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think, 100%. I think we're not good at getting to those root causes. We just like to, look at the symptoms and treat them and not actually get to the root cause of what might be causing the symptoms or look deeper. So, yeah.
But I don't think we like to. You just said we like to do that. I don't think we like to, because nobody I know, whether it's looking at their, you know, mental health issues or physical health issues, I don't know anybody, or even, you know, behavioral problems with horses, whatever. I don't know of anybody who gets to the point to where they look at things holistically. They look at the whole system, how it's all connected, and they can understand the beginning of the problem. I don't know anybody that does that and goes, forget all that crap. I'm just going to buy a pill. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think we, if you are given the choice or given the understanding, that you would make the choice to go, no, I don't want to know about that. It's just where our society conditions us to not look at things that way. But I don't think.
I agree with you.
You know what I mean? I don't think we make the decision to not look at things that way. We get conditioned to look at things that way.
100%. Yeah, I agree. We're in this pattern, right? Of not looking, or of, I agree with what you're saying 100%. Like, conditioning, or just a pattern of that's how we do things. Until someone kind of shakes up the system or shines a light on something, we just do what we always do, or what habitually we've done, which I think I agree is more just kind of surface level typically.
Yeah, like with you, once you understood what tapping did for you, didn't go, oh yeah, that's all right, but yeah, no, forget that. That's
exactly
that's Chinese medicine crap.
I couldn't unsee it. 100%. Yeah. I could not unsee it. Yeah,
you can't. You know, you can't unsee. I don't think you can unsee.
No, I agree.
Any of those things. I want to ask you about how much you know. And this is not like a quiz. I'm just interested in what you know, put it that way, about the origins of EFT. Who was there? A person who discovered it?
Yeah. So it started kind of around the time when acupuncture became big in the US, which I believe was 60s and 70s. There's that famous story of Nixon going over to China and like one of his aides seeing someone, I think like having surgery with like only using acupuncture or acupuncture, I think, something like that, the story goes. And so that kind of started this whole interest in acupuncture in the US in the 60s and 70s. And then various people, including Roger Callahan, started realizing, oh, we can actually just use the fingers and put pressure on these acupressure points and not actually need the needles, and that the fingers putting pressures on these acupressure points are just as effective. So that started happening. Roger Callahan had a famous case where he was a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but he was working with someone who had a severe phobia of water. And he kind of one day was like, oh, maybe I'll try this acupressure thing, and started kind of tapping on her as they were working on this phobia. And she went home and said, I went swimming. And he was like, wait, impossible. I don't believe you, basically. And the next day came back and just walked into his pool and was like, totally fine. And it was kind of a famous case of one of these overnight successes of clearing her phobia that she'd had for her entire life in like one sort of hour long sort of EFT session early days. And then a student of Roger Callahan, Gary Craig, he was the one that kind of really systematizes EFT and kind of wrote the first manual kind of in the 80s, really kind of setting the structure of clinical EFT. So I think he is the one that's attributed kind of systematizing what we think of now as clinical EFT. Yep. And it evolved into the kind of the clinical EFT manual now that Dawson Church wrote. So that's kind of the trajectory. It came out of the fascination with acupressure and then realizing you actually could use it without needles.
Have you ever had acupuncture?
I have. Yeah. How long ago was that now? Is it a year and a half ago, I had a fall horse riding and I broke my shoulder in five places. And I went through physical therapy and I used acupuncture to help me with that, to post that. And I found it very helpful.
Mm.
Yeah. I also use myofascia too, which I found profoundly helpful.
What was it again? Sorry.
Myofascia. Do you know that form of therapy? It's so basically in my physical therapy journey for my post my shoulder, it was the physical therapy for my shoulder was more traumatic than the actual fall. Like it was so painful and so painful. And it got to the point in my physical therapy journey where I was kind of at like 90%, I would say, range of motion, 90% kind of back to normal, quote unquote. But I wasn't getting that last 10%. And it was so incredibly painful to the fact that like I would finish like a half hour, not even half hour, 20 minutes PT session and just kind of walk home in this like daze. I would tap. I would have to like clear my schedule for like a good hour to kind of come back into my body. It was just so painful. And I just felt deeply at some point, this can't be helpful. Like I'm not improving. And this just this goes against everything I believe in terms of healing and like trauma, like this can't be the answer to get me back to kind of normal. And I was actually talking to one of my mentees, one of my EFT mentees. I was having a meeting with her, going over some of her session notes, and I was telling her about it. And she said, have you ever tried myofascia? And I said, no. And she said, it's incredibly gentle. It literally feels like they're not doing anything. I think you should really try it. And I was desperate to get back to normal, quote unquote. And I Googled it. I found someone. And I did six sessions with her and my shoulder went sort of 99.9% back to normal, like in six sessions. And I never went back to my PT. And it's so gentle. It's literally like, taking the shoulder and holding it. And it literally feels like they're not doing anything. And they're ever so gently kind of, I guess, pulling it, pushing it, just holding it. And it literally gives your body so much safety, is my experience of it, that it releases. And I had so much overcompensation from, you know, other muscles doing things when my shoulder couldn't work. And the trauma to my shoulder of, frankly, I think the physical therapy, everything in my body was like holding onto it, not wanting it to move, didn't want to be more in pain. And so the myofascia, yeah, anyway, I'm a big proponent of myofascia after my experience, so.
Yeah, I've not heard the term before. I'm wondering if it's anything like, say, craniosacral work or the Rosen method or any of those sorts of very gentle.
I mean, I'm sure. So it's literally, you're literally just moving the fascia, right? Like you're literally just moving it so gently. So it's myofascia because you're literally moving the fascia, releasing the fascia and all those connective tissues that get so tight. And so, yeah, craniosacral. I took my son to that years ago, is more, I would say, spine alignment, right? Is more of a literally craniosacral. So right. I think, as I understand it, less, but similar in the sense of it's very gentle.
Right.
But myofascia, yeah, it's incredibly gentle, literally encouraging the fascia, all that connective tissue to release. And yeah, I mean, it's lovely. I was looking at, in terms of horse things, there's a woman I now follow. You may have heard of it. I want to say, like, there's a nerve release right now that I was just reading about with horses that seems like, to me, similar, where you're just a light bit of pressure and the horses release into it, like very gentle, very soft. And it reminded me of my experience with myofascia. So that's something I would note to self that I'm going to look into soon.
Yeah, it could be something like the Masterson method or something like that.
Yeah, or like it's, I can't remember. Yeah, I want to say it's Lazarus nerve release.
Oh, okay. Like that. Yeah. Celeste.
Yes. Celeste, there we go.
Celeste, yeah.
So I don't know much about her work, but the little videos I looked at, I was like, oh, that's myofascia for horses. It's so gentle.
Right.
You're holding space. You're trusting the body to do the healing, right, in a way. It's not about pushing it or pulling it into obedience, right? You talk about with horses, like you can't force into obedience. It's literally like offering the shoulder. It can heal itself. It can relax. It's safe to release.
Right. Yeah.
Sounding very woo-woo here right now, but it's that same idea that I felt like my physical therapy got to the point where it was like you're against, like forcing the horse to do something out of fear, like pushing it into it, as opposed to myofascia, which was just like, we're just going to hold it and we're just going to invite some release. We're just going to trust that you can heal it. And if the body wants to be released, and if we can give it the right circuit, you know, the right circumstance, the body wants to be calm. The body wants to be relaxed.
Yeah. In your physical therapy, did you have any breakthroughs as far, not so much as far as repairing your shoulder? I have a friend who had an accident here a while ago, not a horse-related accident, and she is doing some physical therapy now. And she messaged me the other day and she said, I'm learning so much from the pain. She said, I've done my share of unconsciously running from emotional pain in my life, and it's surprising how physical pain and how small and vulnerable it can make you feel, and how it can be a key to unlocking what really needs to be released internally. Those are her words. She texted to me. I just looked it up. did you find, you know, if it was that painful, did you find anything like that? I mean, I don't think everybody has that, been running from emotional pain.
I feel like, no, I can't say I did. I feel like, especially since, you know, doing this work, if I feel something higher than a kind of a 3 on a subscale of 0 to 10, it's like, I'm going to tap at it, right? Like I want to know where things come from. I'm like, I'm open vessel. But my experience with the pain, yeah, it was pain that I have not experienced before. It was mind-boggling pain. And I gave birth to my son, like, naturally, like in our bedroom. And it was like, it was nothing. Like this was like pain. It felt like pain with no purpose. That's what it was.
Mm.
Like when you're in childbirth, this pain and this purpose, it's every painful, you know, wave is like you're getting closer to something. My shoulder just felt like pain, even though technically, I guess it was allegedly getting closer to mobility, it just felt like there was no, yeah, it didn't feel like I had pain with purpose. It just felt pain.
Mm.
I did practice, one of the things, studies they did recently with EFT is that, you know, using the power of the subconscious, if you really visualize yourself tapping, right? If you're someone who struggles with insomnia and you're lying in bed and you don't want to actually move your arms to tap, and you actually just kind of visualize or imagine yourself tapping, it can almost be as effective. And so I would do that. As I was doing my physical therapy where I literally couldn't move, where I couldn't tap, I would kind of play with that imaginary tapping and imagine myself tapping, which is surprisingly effective. So I did play with that in the painful moments. But yeah, I can't say I had any big spiritual awakenings through my pain, unfortunately. Mm.
Oh well.
I missed out on that. I mean, I wish I'd had more benefits from it, but no, I can't say I did.
So the other thing that you mentioned earlier on that sounded kind of interesting to me is, tell me what it's like touring around Europe as an actor.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. I mean, it's a dream job, at least in my experience, because, you know, you have to be, I mean, my experience, I was doing a show that I'd been doing for over a year. I loved it. It was a great group of people. And I always showed up giving it my all, but I also could have done it kind of in my sleep, you know. It was a show I knew very well. And I had to be at the theater at 6 o'clock at night. It was a pretty short show. You know, I'd get there at 6, we'd do a show at 8, we'd be wrapped by 10:30. And then I had all day to just kind of see a new place. And for me, it was heaven. You got a per diem, so you had all your, you know, you had money to spend and, you know, to get lunch and get breakfast and be out. And for me, it was just an amazing opportunity just to see some more of the world. I went to Japan, which was amazing. Someone had always wanted to go that I'd never been to. And yeah, it was fantastic. It was just like, yeah, I loved it. It was
so
really great.
What countries did you get to go to?
So we went to Holland, Germany, Luxembourg, Japan on that tour. I might be missing another European country. I can't remember where else. Belgium, I think. Oh, Belgium. Yeah, Belgium.
Okay.
So it was like four or five in Europe and then Japan.
Yep. And it was a theater, like a stage show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think sometimes like in the, you know, early on in a lot of actors' careers, they do like non-equity tours, which have lower budgets and in smaller theaters. And that can be much more of like a, what's the word? Hands-on kind of experience where you're an actor in the show, but you're also helping unload the sets and you're doing kind of some labor and it's much more kind of low budget. And so you're kind of hands on deck. And a lot of people do that when they've just graduated college or in their 20s, right? But this was not that. This was like, we're in beautiful hotels and we're in gorgeous theaters. And then we have like all day, every day to explore a new city. And you know, he was a very well-known avant-garde theater director. He was probably even more popular in Europe than he was in the States. So we were incredibly well-received and, yeah, it was just like, I mean, it just felt so luxurious. It was just like, we got all day to kind of see a city and then we got to do a great show and great talkbacks and yeah, it was fun.
How many were in the cast?
We had, let me see, 4, 8.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, about 8 of us.
Pretty small.
Yeah, I'm very grateful for that experience. It was my first, that job was really my first professional, was it? Yeah, my first equity show as an actor and then my first big tour. And it was a long time ago now, but it was really, yeah, I'm very grateful for that experience. It was really just fantastic.
You know, I was about to ask a really silly question. I was going to say, so what did you think of Europe? But you grew up in England, so you know. Because the thing about I'm Australian, but I live in the US. But the thing about someone from Australia, from the US, going to from a young country going to Europe for the first time is you are just dumbstruck by the the buildings and the age of the buildings and the cathedrals and things like that. But you grew up in England. So, I mean, you're used to.
Yeah. Yeah. So that I didn't have that experience because I grew up in England. I did French exchanges since, since I was about 10, my parents would just like, we would just like get the boat over to England and drop me off at a family for 2 weeks in a French family. And then come get me 2 weeks later. And we did, we take the ferry to Paris and then ferry to France and then just kind of drive all over Europe. So I had certainly seen a lot of Europe. But to go back as a, early 20 something independently as a professional actor was thrilling back then.
And so your entire US experience has been in New York, hasn't it? Like you've lived there the whole time?
Yeah. So we moved to New Jersey. So I finished up high school in New Jersey. Then I went to California for 4 years. So
oh, where in California?
I went to Los Angeles. I went to UCLA for university.
Oh, really? Where'd you study there?
Theater, film, and television.
Okay.
On brand. And then drove cross country back to New York about a week after I graduated to start working with this theater company that I was just talking about. So I was there 4 years. I loved it. But, I was talking to someone about this the other day, because when I was in California, I loved it. I had only been in the country a couple of years. So talking about experiences, right? I grew up in England, not now because global warming, but when I was growing up, it really did almost rain every day. It was like very, you know, it rained a lot. And so when I got off the plane in California to look at UCLA, and it's just sunny and there's palm trees, and it just felt like paradise, right? It just felt like this is, I've seen in the movie, it just felt like another world. Like it just was that, it's what I imagine people feel when they go to Europe, right? It's like from here, it was that experience of like, what is this place? This place is just what? And so much of my college experience was also traveling and seeing the US, which I hadn't seen. I'd only been in the country a couple of years. So even just within California, going down to Santa Barbara and up to San Francisco and down to Mexico and over to Utah and like traveling around the West Coast, I hadn't seen any of that. So for me, that was just a whole new world. So a lot of my college experience was just West Coast, like, wow. So, yeah. And it's funny too, because then when I was there, I was very, very judgmental also about like, oh, everyone's so slow here and they don't have the New York hustle. And, you know, I want to get back. I'd love it here, but I'm definitely going to go back to New York where people like, you know, all the real people are. And I was drawn to that New York hustle, right? But now, of course, as I'm older, you know, a lot of my habitual habits around hustling, about working hard, around over preparation, which I kind of collapsed into that New Yorker East Coast mentality, for me, are really a trauma response, right? Like, yes. I really am clear on that. And so now I would make that decision very differently. And I've had so much awareness of that over the last 4 years and things that I thought were just kind of who I were and really a great strength. And they were a good strength. They have served me. And I got to the point where, maybe this is feeling a little out of alignment now. And then, of course, you trace it back and it's like absolutely a trauma response on some level. So it's, I would make that decision differently now. But that's
one of those things we talked about before. Like once you unsee it, you can't see it anymore. 100%. Now, when you see people who are in the hustle culture, you don't look at them and go, oh, wow, they're rocking it. You kind of think, you poor person. You don't even realize the motivation behind the thing that you're doing. Even though you think you are succeeding, you are actually running on the hamster wheel and there's trauma, there's unresolved trauma behind your actions.
Yeah. And you wear it with a badge of honor too, right? I wore my kind of like, I really over-prepare, I work hard, I'll never show up without like, you know, doing four times as much work as is actually necessary as like a point of pride, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, then it got to the point where it was like, okay, this is really not serving me anymore and this is not sustainable. But that's where it started coming up for me. I was like, this doesn't feel sustainable anymore. Like I actually don't need to prepare this much, but when I want to prepare less, I actually feel unsafe. I feel like I'll prepare anyway, right? Like I couldn't not prepare. Stop the behavior. Yeah. I couldn't not prepare. And then it was like, where does that come from? I figured out where it comes from. And again, now I can show up differently. Or if I do start to feel activated, talking about your parts work, I can kind of connect with that part, let that part of me have a voice for a moment. And then she quietens down and then I can go about my day.
Yeah. Have you read much of Brené Brown stuff?
Yes.
You know, it was her that was the first place that I, reading some of her stuff, the first place I became aware of that whole hustle culture, how it's a, you know, trauma response. But she was talking about how she went to, I think she went to New York and rode up and down an elevator in a big law firm in New York one day, just listening to the elevator conversations. And these two guys get in the elevator like, what time did you go home last night? And the guy says, I went home at 2:00. How about you? And the other guy's like, I haven't been home yet. And they're wearing it like they're wearing it like a badge of honor, you know. And then she went on to discuss how, and it's, you know, the same thing when I was a horse, professional horse trainer and training horses and going to horse shows and, you know, like it's a badge of honor to, you know, haven't taken a day off in 6 weeks or, you know, rode till 2:00 this morning, then got up at 5 and, you know, yes, not cool.
Yeah, absolutely not cool. Yeah. I agree.
Not cool. When you went to UCLA, and what did you say you studied?
Theater, film and television. Yeah.
Did anybody?
So it wasn't a conservatory program. So it was like I majored in theater and acting, basically, but took lots of other classes as well.
Right. Did anybody that you went to school with there, quote unquote, make it?
I feel like the answer has to be yes there. I mean, the first person that comes to mind is Kristen Henke, who was there when I was there, and she's a very successful director and writer now. She's actually not an actor anymore, but she's a fantastic director and writer. I think not in my particular like graduating class. There was no one that sort of, quote, quote, as you said, air quotes, made it. But certainly lots of graduates in that program are kind of around and in the ether. Yeah.
Yeah, because I imagine it's one of those things that there is a pinnacle to it. Like this is, you know, that's the thing I'd like. Whereas if you go to law school, you might not necessarily think that you're going to be, you know, doing the O.J. Simpson case or something big.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it depends what your, again, everyone has different definitions of made it, right? If you're talking about like mass celebrity status, or if you're talking about, which I think was always just my goal of just like making enough that I could just live off just being an actor, not needing to hold a side hustle, which
right.
I would have periods when I would and then periods when I wouldn't. And my goal was always just kind of to be able to just be an actor, you know, which is getting more and more difficult, hence the current strike situation. But I think I also, there's a huge number. I mean, I'd be interested to know the stats actually of that graduating class who are no longer actors, because it's very different, you know. The lifestyle of an actor is very different than the playing, artistic expression, joyful, nothing but creation experience of like 4 years just studying acting and then getting into the quote-unquote real world is very different experience, which I think a lot of programs don't prepare you for, and certainly brings up lots of beliefs, you know, really moves your stuff around in terms of how you can show up in a business that, you know, of course, famously has a lot of rejection, famously, like the odds are not in your favor, famously, you know, it's a challenging business to be in.
Yeah, it's a little bit like horse training. I think people think, oh, it'd be great to just ride horses all day long, but you know, that has its shelf life too. Can you tell us about some of the, I mean, you know, only as much as you can share, but some of the real success stories you've had with people as far as helping writers with their trauma with the EFT?
Yeah. So I have, I was talking to a potential client yesterday, and I was actually quoted you in when I was talking to her. I was like, Warwick Schiller has this great quote around, you can't fake it till you make it with horses. And I was talking to her about that, and I was telling her this client story, and it can be sometimes just really simple things. I had a client who, she couldn't rug her horse. Like she described the horse as a bit pushy, but she just couldn't, she was really nervous around him. She like was fine with him, but putting rugs on, she just like, she felt like she couldn't do it. She felt like she was going to get kicked all the time, and her partner could put rugs on. Right. And so she knew it was her, right? Like she knew she was the sticking point because her partner could rug him totally fine. And she couldn't. And the more she had problems with it, the more those neural pathways were kind of like neural highways where she would get anxious, she would go get the rug, she would feel nervous, the horse would feel it, his energy would shift. And it was this kind of vicious loop of energetic, you know, not helpfulness. And we did one session where we kind of work through that. And she could show up completely differently after that. And the very next, that night, she literally went out, tended to her nervous system, put the rugs on, absolutely no problem, did the leg straps, which are the big sticking points, mm-hmm. and it completely changed the relationship with her horse. And then a couple of days later, she was like, my horse has totally changed. And it was not, and the horse didn't really change. She changed.
Right. Yep.
And then the horse should show up differently. Right. And she was like, you've literally changed my horse. And I was like, I didn't change your horse at all. You're showing up differently. So now your horse is like feeling safer. Your horse is feeling that you're incongruent. So, you know, incongruency. So now it feels safe. It can show up for you. So it can be little things like that that can just really shift with EFT. And then I've had other clients who have had kind of, you know, like the worst of the worst falls, like really scary, like traumatic falls, that the fall itself is super traumatic. And then they've had, you know, lots of injuries because of said falls. And, you know, I had one client who really thought, you know, really wanted to ride again. And, you know, every time she would go to the barn, she would be like, it's going to be fine. She would use her mindset tools. She's like, it's going to be fine. I'm going to be okay. And, but the minute she put her foot in the stirrup, it was like, she would have this massive nervous system reaction. Right. And she would have, and she hadn't been able to ride since this accident. And she didn't have flashbacks, but she said she couldn't tell the story of the accident without just crying. So it was so present for her. Like it was literally still happening in her present when she would talk about it. So she's like, I can't tell the story. As soon as I start talking about it or thinking about it, I start crying. I haven't been able to ride. I put my foot in the stirrup, even though I think I'm fine up until that point. The minute I put my foot in the stirrup, my heart races. I just feel panic. I can't do it. And, you know, we work together really slowly. When there's trauma, we can go super slowly with EFT, right? And just really gently moved through that accident for her and all those little aspects that were holding those charges so that we could really get her brain to process that again, to let the brain know it was safe, that event was over, literally changing the tag in her brain so that then after 4 sessions, she could ride again. And she was totally fine. She's back riding right after we finished working together. She did a horse riding retreat and like rode for like a full weekend. And she's just like back in the saddle and happy and feeling great about riding again. And that's just such to go from like those extremes where you just feel like you really can't ride and your body feels so out of control to, yeah, just like reconnecting with the joy of riding again. It's such a privilege to support people on that journey.
Yeah, I've got to back up a second. You actually said you quoted me, which was, you know, fake
it
to
make
it.
You.
Well, actually, the quote's not me. The quote is a previous podcast guest who actually happens to be here at our place at the moment is Jane Pike from New Zealand. Jane's the one that said,
Oh, interesting. I totally co-opted it and thought it was you.
That's funny. No, well, I have said it, but I got it from Jane. So Jane.
Amazing.
Jane Pike and Rupert Isaacson, both previous podcast guests, actually did a retreat here this weekend at our place. And it was, Rob and I got to be a part of it and watch, you know, be involved in it. It was good not giving the retreat, but being in the retreat, being a part of it.
So, I'm sure.
Yeah, it was.
And what do they do? Remind me what they do. Maybe I've listened. I must have listened to that one, I'm sure.
Rupert is the guy that made the movie The Horse Boy. So Rupert's son, Rowan, was having some struggles with his autism, and he took him to Mongolia to the horse riding shamans Mongolia to do some healing around some of the problems he was having associated with his autism. That was many, many years ago. So Rupert started a thing called the Horse Boy Method, which is a method of helping autistic children with various, you know, problems they have with their autism. And Jane is what is Jane? Let's call her an equestrian mindset coach, even though these days she's probably a whole lot more than that. But yeah, but anyway, yeah. So Jane's quotes basically, I think Jane's quote might be faking it till you make it with horses is bullshit. is the exact quote. But you know, it's interesting. It's so cool what you're doing because, you know, horses are such energetic creatures, and if your energy is all jangled and disconnected. Like the lady that couldn't rug a horse, you know, her partner could rug the horse and she couldn't. The horse would show up a certain way because she showed up a certain way. And when you sorted that part of it out, the horse was completely different. And that's very cool, because sometimes people would present that as a horse problem. How do I fix my horse? And, you know, it that could be a, you know, parallel could be, how do I fix my husband? How do I fix my, you know, it's like everything, you know, you, Dawson Church probably talks about this, but you create your own reality, don't you? With the thoughts you put out there, the energy you put out there attached to those thoughts, your expectations, all of that stuff. So that's very cool what you're doing. Do you have a simple like tapping practice that we can actually, you can share with us on the podcast?
Yeah, like to do like together now, like in real time.
Yeah,
in real time. We can do something, simple. I mean, obviously we won't do anything, you know, open up anything.
So people at home can kind of tap along as well.
Yeah. So is there something using, if you're my client in this scenario, is there something that you could focus on? You could say it out loud if you're comfortable, or not if you're not comfortable. That is like a just kind of a something that happened in the last couple of weeks that's maybe annoying or stressful. Nothing too big, like maybe a 5 or less on the kind of scale of like stress. Something that someone said that's still bugging you, or something.
I don't have a particular incident, but I have been having this low level anxiety that I don't normally have, like a feeling in my stomach of it's almost like I just feel slightly queasy, but I know it's not something I ate sort of a thing. It's just this, I wake up and it's kind of constant. It has been for a couple of weeks now, which is totally unusual for me. So how's that sound?
Sounds good. And do you feel it right now, this kind of low level queasiness?
Yeah. Yes.
And now out of 0 to 10, like how is that queasiness right now? If 0 is like no queasiness, 10
well, let's
is like,
let's not go with queasiness. Queasiness was just a way to kind of describe it. It's a, you could almost term it like a feeling of dread, or a feeling of worry, or a feeling of something doesn't feel quite right.
Yeah.
And I think it's actually got something to do with my parts work that I've been doing. We're starting to unravel some things that have been kind of clamped up quite shut for a while. So I don't think it's a bad thing, but you asked what's going on, and that's the thing I can feel, yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of this dread, this worry in your stomach, and if you just have to kind of tune into it and just, you know, trusting whatever comes up. Is there a shape or color of that kind of dread, worry in your stomach?
You know,
it might not be.
But just being so disconnected from my body most of my life, whenever therapists and people ask these sorts of questions, I'm like, oh shit, I don't know.
So that's fine. You don't have to force anything. You don't. Okay.
I don't have a color, but I do have a shape. It's like a long, thin thing stretching from one side to the other.
Yeah, long, thing stretching one side. Yeah. And again, 0 to 10 right now. What? How activating is that? How strong is that sensation?
3. 3.
Yeah. Okay. Great. So we're just gonna follow along. Can you see my hands here?
Oh, sorry.
So we're gonna tap on the side of the hand. So you've got the. Make sure you can see here. So you've got the kind of the crease of the finger there, and you're just going to tap with three
or four
fingers.
So we need to explain this for people at home.
So you're going to tap on the side of your hand. So if you use 3 or 4 fingers, just tap on the side of the hand.
So this is just below where your pinky finger meets your hand. If you've got to kind of karate chop something, that's where you'd karate chop them with.
Exactly. We used to call this point the karate chop point, but now it's not very inclusive, so we don't call it that anymore. But yes, exactly. So you can use 3 or 4 fingers, and we're going to start on the side of the hand. Two things I want to pre-frame before we start tapping. One is that there's a lot of repetition, and 2 is that with clinical EFT, we really focus on the negative, right? One of the, you know, we're counter conditioning. So I think some of the not so helpful tapping is when they go right to the positive, right? We always want to start with the negative, shift that first before we move into the positive. So I just want to kind of preframe that first. So we're going to start on the side of the hand and we're going to
Before you go any further here, can you take your finger and tap on your microphone with the tempo that you're tapping on your hand so people at home can get...
So I'm sort of tapping... But there's no real right or wrong. It's
okay,
really,
I was just wondering if it was fast or it was slow.
Yeah, I think, just tap at a, I always think about it as like, it's about the same pressure as if you would tap on a table. You imagine tapping on a table, it's that kind of pressure.
Kind of like drumming your fingers sort of thing?
Exactly.
Okay.
And you're just going to tap there and there's no right or wrong, just trust your instinct. So you're just going to start on the side of the hand. Whew, and Warwick, you're just going to repeat after me. It's like a Simon Says.
Okay.
Even though I have this long, thin sensation in my stomach.
Even though I have this long, thin sensation in my stomach.
This dread or worry.
This dread or worry.
It's a 3 out of 10.
It's a 3 out of 10.
But I have compassion for myself and my body.
But I have compassion for myself and my body.
So just acknowledging what is, even though I have this long, thin sensation.
Even though I have this long, thin sensation.
It's stretched out.
It's stretched out.
From one side to the other.
From one side to the other.
Maybe it's dread or worry.
Maybe it's dread or worry.
But I'm open to being gentle with myself.
But I'm open to being gentle with myself.
Even though I have this long, thin, stretched out sensation.
Even though I have this long, thin, stretched out sensation.
Maybe it's worry.
Maybe it's worry.
I'm letting my body know.
I'm letting my body know.
That right here in this moment...
That right here in this moment,
I'm okay.
I'm okay.
So now I'm going to go to the top of the head. So just right on the top of your head. I'm going to move my headphones a little bit. So right on the top of the head, if you put your thumbs on your top of your ears and where your middle fingers touch, right on the top of the head there. I'm just going to tap there. Oh, this long, thin sensation in my stomach.
This long, thin sensation in my stomach.
Oh, this 3 out of 10.
This 3 out of 10.
I'm going to go to the eyebrows, right at the beginning where your eyebrow meets the bridge of the nose. Beautiful. Oh, this sensation in my stomach.
Oh, this sensation in my stomach.
Just breathing into that sensation in your stomach, wherever you feel that. Just breathing into it. Side of the eye. Now we're going right on the eye. It's right on the bone, right next to the eye there. Oh, this long, thin sensation in my stomach.
This long, thin sensation in my stomach.
And then we're going under the eye. So it's right on the bone again, right under the pupil, right on that ocular bone there. Oh, this worry in my stomach.
This worry in my stomach.
This long, thin, stretched out sensation.
This long, thin, stretched out sensation.
Under the nose, right under the nose now. Acknowledging and processing. Going to the chin point, right under the mouth. I don't have to let go of all of this.
I don't have to let go of all of this.
But I wonder if I can let just a little bit go.
But I wonder if I can let just a little bit go.
And then we're going to the collarbone, so right below the collarbone, that little divot there.
Both sides?
On both sides. Yeah, you can do it both sides or one. Oh, this sensation in my stomach. This long, thin sensation. Oh, and just tuning into it in your body, just feeling it, however you feel it, just tuning into it. Letting yourself see that long, thin, stretched out from one side to the other. And under the arm, almost like a hand width. If you put your hand under your armpit, your bottom of your hand touches. Oh, this sensation in my stomach. Yeah, lots of deep breath. And just finishing on the side of the hand again, one more time. Even with the sensation in my stomach. I have compassion for myself and my body. Just taking a deep breath. That's letting the tapping go and just, yeah, just tuning in. How is that sensation in your stomach? That 3 out of 10, how's it feeling?
Feels like it's gotten a lot smaller and it's probably a 1 now. I've kind of got to think about trying to find it. That's really interesting.
Awesome. So that, so you did it with a physical sensation, right? And any emotion is a physical sensation. So the most gentle way to process something is if you're feeling like anxious, right? I'm just making an example up. If you're feeling anxious, you feel like your head is spinning. It's like, don't get into even the head, don't get out of your head, right? What that means or what you've been thinking about. Just tune into the physical sensation, right? Even though I feel like my head is spinning so fast. And the setup statement is just around acceptance. So it's just like, I have compassion for myself. Even though my head is spinning, I choose to be gentle with myself, right? There's options you can use. Even though my head is spinning, I choose to accept my body's reaction. Right. And then we're just focusing on that unwanted sensation, right? My head is spinning, Right. And by sending counter conditioning that stress, that body sensation, that event with the tapping, you're just letting the body know it's safe. It's letting the body know it's safe. It can process it and it drops. So that's the kind of basic recipe of EFT. We just did one round, next I'd probably go into like, what is it? Let's get a message from your body. What is that about? What is that work? Right. We'd go deeper, but I think that's a good way to just kind of start the practice. So again, you're just starting on the side of the hand and you're just using some sort of statement around acceptance or compassion with whatever it is, right? Even though I'm really stressed out about this upcoming meeting, it makes sense. I feel this way, even though I'm really stressed out about this meeting tomorrow, I really want to do a good job. But I accept that's how I feel right now. Even though I'm really stressed out about this meeting tomorrow, I have compassion for myself and everything I'm feeling. I'm so stressed out about this meeting. And then you tap through the points. I'm so stressed out, right? And you focus on the negative first. And then by the end, it's like, you know what? It's okay. Of course I'm stressed out. I've never done this kind of meeting before. Of course I'm stressed out. I'm a little stressed out, but it's okay, right? It makes sense I'm stressed out. It's a, you know, whatever it is. So does that make sense? Any questions coming up? That was kind of a rapid fire, basic recipe EFT, but hopefully
right.
That made sense.
Are you always working on a particular thing, or can you just tap just to tap? Like, is there a therapeutic thing to, if you just were to go through those steps without having a particular goal in mind? Can you do that?
So if you literally just tapped on the points alone, that would calm your nervous system. So 100%. If you literally, one of the things I do with the new clients oftentimes, because this, like normally with a client, I would go through the points first to really make sure you knew where they were.
Right.
Then we go into the tapping, right? We kind of combined it and I was like, tap here. And so it's a little bit awkward. So, but what I normally do with new clients is I get them just to take a breath and kind of gauge that breath 0 to 10, how kind of expansive it feels. Then I just show them the points. It's like, this is exactly where this point is. This is exactly where this point is. Tap here. We just go through the points. And then I have them take a breath. And always their breath is like, they're like, oh my God, it's so much more expansive. Mm. Right? I can take such a deeper breath. I feel it's so much, I have so much more movement in my diaphragm, right? So just the points alone will absolutely calm your nervous system, will allow you to take a deeper breath. And that alone is enough. A lot of my clients just do that before bed. And you can simplify in other ways too. I always think sometimes in everyday life, you know, time can be a barrier to entry for some people. And so it's like, as you're doing your teeth, right? It's like, just tap on your collarbone point as you kind of focus on that meeting that you're nervous about that you're doing later that day, right? And just breathe and focus on that meeting as you're tapping, as you're doing your teeth, right? You can kind of combine it in these micro ways too, to kind of just, again, just process stress, get your nervous system relaxed.
And do you do them in those orders first, like the side of the hand, the top of the head, the bridge in the nose, the beside the eye, the under the eye, the under the nose, the chin?
Yeah, so that's kind of exactly. Yeah, so that's kind of the basic recipe, and you're getting kind of all those main meridians that way. You know, it's not a big deal if you have to skip one, right? Like when I had my shoulder, I literally couldn't move my dominant arm, so I had to sort of change points. You know, I've had clients who, you know, any number of reasons, don't want to touch their face for some reason one day. Maybe there's a pimple or something, so skip a point, not a big deal. But you don't have to technically do it in that order either. But it just generally is like, that's the order that clinical EFT is in. It's just, it's easier to kind of keep the same order, so it becomes habitual for people.
Right. Yeah. And how long is it important? How long you do each one?
In terms of the points.
Is there too much or too little?
No, I mean, I think, you know, the technical answer would be kind of one inhale, one exhale, but it's really intuitive. Like, you can't do that wrong, right? I often, and a lot of people find certain points really their favorite, if you will. Like, I have certain clients who, like, I just love this point. That's always my go-to. If I'm feeling stressed, this is the point I go to, right? Other people are like, I just love the top of my head when I have headaches, or, you know, so a lot of people have a favorite point. I love the collarbone because I can do that. Clients do that, can do that in the New York City subway. You don't need to have clean hands if they don't want to touch their face. You can do this, you know, very surreptitiously. It's an easy one to access whatever you're wearing, right? Like, it's just an easy one to access. So a lot of people have kind of favorite points, but there's no, yeah, if you have to skip a point for some reason, it's not a problem.
Right. Yeah, it kind of has a comforting feeling to it while you're doing it.
Yeah. I mean, you're literally lowering your cortisol. You're lowering your cortisol and you're telling the body it's safe, right? And that we did one round in a very, not super awkward, but not in a smooth way, right? I'm telling you where the points are. You've never done it before. You're managing headphones and, you know, trying to see me on a tiny screen, right? It wasn't the most smooth, but even that just, you know, you can sense how it does kind of calm your nervous system and kind of reduce some of these aspects. So yeah, it's very effective.
That was very cool. So how do people find you?
So you can definitely find me on Instagram. I finally joined Instagram and about a few months ago, and I'm there. So definitely find me at Sarah Louise Lilly on Instagram and join the community there. You can also go to emotionalfreedomwithsarah.com. I send out weekly kind of really actionable tools and inspiring stories, client success stories every week. So if you want to join that, you can join that community there. So those are the two easiest places to find me.
Okay. And they can message you on Instagram, or your email is on your website, is it?
Yeah. It's just Emotional Freedom with Sarah. Yeah.
Perfect. Awesome. Yeah. Well, it's been a very fun time having a chat with you about EFT. You know, I've been aware of the tapping for quite a while, but I haven't really done much of it. My wife's done a little bit of it. And I was really interested to find out more, especially seeing you're working with equestrians and you're helping them with trauma from falls and stuff. So I thought that part was very, very interesting. So yeah, it's been great chatting with you, and thanks so much for joining me.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure and honor to be on your show.
And you guys at home, thanks for joining us. And we'll catch you on the next episode of the Journey On Podcast.
Thanks for being a part of the Journey On Podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick has over 850 full-length training videos on his online video library at videos.warwickschiller.com. Be sure to follow Warwick on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram to see his latest training advice and insights.